The only time, I did something last time I made a similar presentation here at SMI, because it was 10:30, the meeting had been long, and I was really extremely nervous the hour was going by, because I had some things that were fairly intense to say, and I said everybody sort of ready to nod out. In that talk, I gave permission for everybody to fall asleep, because I realized, I said, hey, if you fall asleep, you fall down the aisles, I won't be offended. In fact, if you have to get up and yawn or stretch or whatever, I won't be offended. Fall asleep, I won't be offended. I'm not giving that permission this morning. I hope you're in a little better shape. Yesterday, Carolyn talked a little bit about the story of Esperanza and the story of some of the things that we went through. What I really want to do this morning, although it may not seem like it at first, is talk a little bit about the foundations of why Esperanza came into being and why other things like this come into being. Let me just start by saying Esperanza was not born out of compassion. The great mistake I think that people make in terms of reaching out to the poor, etc., is to try to do that out of compassion. Esperanza came out of obedience. Esperanza is not an optional add-on to what the church should be doing. What we discovered is that it is integral to what Jesus is doing on the earth. And the problem with doing things out of compassion is we run out of compassion. But when we do something out of our relationship with Jesus, we never run out of it. When we do what he is doing, he energizes us and equips us and empowers us. And I really want to get that point across, because the danger is that people, I believe it's dangerous, people will run out and hear a great story about Esperanza and they try to whip up some compassion and try to do similar things, and it fails because we run out of compassion. We don't run out of Jesus. And so if we are doing what Jesus is doing, then he is doing it through us, and then we never run out of whatever we have to run out of. And I hope you'll get that picture. And what I have to share this morning may seem a little abstract to begin with, but I hope you'll get something of the framework of what we discovered Jesus said about what he is doing on earth and how we fit into that. Okay? Let me see. I gave you the notes because I'm not going to cover all the points in the notes, and later you may wonder, how did he get from point A to point J? Well, the intermediate points are there if you want to talk about the debate. The other thing I want to say by way of beginning is this is not novel and original. I assure you that A, everything I say is really in the Bible, although it may not sound like it. B, it's in good evangelical theology books, and if some of you want to go into that, I can give you references. It's not an original thought here. Maybe the only original thing is in the way it sort of gets knit together, but I don't think I have done... I don't think I've added something to the theological literature in doing this. Unfortunately, a lot of this material doesn't get out on a popular level. In fact, that gets me into talk. I want to get some things which have been written, which men of God and women of God have discovered as they studied the scriptures and interacted with them, to get it out to people so that we can participate, we can benefit from this too. There's a real crisis in the evangelical sphere, which many of us don't even recognize. First of all, Christian lifestyle is becoming increasingly indistinguishable from non-Christian lifestyle. When people do surveys about how sexual behavior of young people on Christian campus or on secular campus, they don't find any statistical difference. We divorce our wives about the same amount that non-Christians divorce our wives. We cheat on our income tax about the same amount. There are scandals among Christian leaders about the same frequency that there are scandals among secular leaders. And so we're getting into this situation where our lifestyles don't match our theology. It's a very serious crisis, because you can't maintain a theology forever if lifestyles don't match it. Eventually then the theology adjusts and changes and adapts to the lifestyle. This is what's happened in liberal transition, liberal wing of the Christian church, and will happen among us evangelicals too, unless something changes. Secondly, what we observe is that our choice and conduct of our vocations is not strongly influenced by Christianity. We were shocked to discover that Christian doctors distribute themselves around the Philadelphia area mostly the same way non-Christians do, and they practice medicine more or less the same way that non-Christian physicians do. And that's not because they're evil or un-Christian, it's that it's never occurred to them that what we do with our life is extremely important to God, because He is doing something in the world that He wants us to participate in, and our choice of vocation is extremely significant to Him. It's not just a private decision. Secondly, it doesn't occur to many Christian health professionals or Christians in any other profession, Christian teachers, etc., that there is a way to practice our professions Christianly. And so we pick up our cues on how to practice the same way, and it doesn't occur to many of us that there's a who, too. That Jesus has something to say about who should get good health care, for example. It doesn't occur to many Christian health professionals that Jesus was the first Christian health professional. He spent an enormous amount of his time healing. And for example, what Carolyn shared last night, our, quote, discovery that there's a connection between people's spiritual life and their physical life, and that when that connection is understood, you get amazing progress in both areas. You get both better, healthy people and more spiritual people. This is a discovery. It shouldn't have been a discovery. This is precisely the way Jesus worked in the New Testament. He was right there in front of us. He taught and He healed. And somehow, we didn't make the connection that that was deliberate. And that He understood the connection, and so we don't even see things like that. And so our vocations tend to be separate from our Christian life is something that we have interiorly, privately, and then we put that aside and let it go out and do medicine or do teaching or do law or whatever, the way everybody else does it. And it doesn't occur to us that Jesus doesn't want us to do that. He is a radical, and He wants us to do our profession in a very different way than anyone else does their profession. Third, while the Christian church and its institutions are growing, its influence on Western society is declining. See, the problem is, churches are filled, but the influence on society is going down. So in the academic area, in the academic arena, for example, in the media arena, we're laughed at. We're not taken seriously, even though we have bigger and better churches and more people singing hymns and praise and worship songs than ever before. The influence on society, but we need to ask ourselves some questions about, well, how can that be? It obviously says something about the quality of Christianity that we're practicing. I think we need to ask some very hard questions about whether our megachurches are even really Christian in the deep sense of the word. Is bringing thousands of bodies into a room and having them sing praise for us, is this Christianity? When's the last time in a megachurch you ever heard something about taking up your cross seriously and following Jesus and denying yourself? Well, we don't hear that nowadays because we say, well, that's not what people want to hear. But then we have to ask some real questions. Are we teaching what Jesus taught, or are we bringing people into buildings and giving them a kind of good religious feeling in the same, are we marketing Christianity to people and they pay their tithes and offering and we give them a good sort of religious inspirational feeling for the moment? And we have to ask ourselves, is this the kind of Christianity that Jesus came to earth and hung on a cross for? See, I think we have to ask this, but the apparent success masks the problem. And what I have to share this morning is to try to help us get kind of a framework to sort of attack this. Let me just give you two more personal entrees into this, so you'll see how my own pilgrimage led to some of the things that that I want to share this morning. First of all, I was discipled at a very young age, and my mom read me the Bible and every Bible story before. I never remember learning a Bible story. I knew them that early. So I knew all the Bible stories. That was great. I mean, I had it all in my head and heart. And then when I was in my mid-teens, I started to be discipled, and there was a man who made me read the Bible and made me think about it. It was really a tremendous thing. But the fact that I was reading the Bible and thinking about it, really, some things really started to disturb me. Jesus started to disturb me. Because, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the Bible about Him fulfilling Old Testament prophecy. But when I read His life, and I read the Old Testament, see, as a kid, I was a little precocious kid that they made read the Bible, and they made think about this, and that's a little dangerous, because when I read the Old Testament, I read Jesus' life, it seemed to me that Jesus was not doing what the Old Testament people expected a Messiah to do. I mean, they really expected a political deliverer, they expected a golden age, they expected wonderful things to take place, peace and justice. I looked at Jesus' life, there's no peace and justice in His society. People were mistreated before and after He left. The Roman Emperor probably never even noticed that the guy had come. Is this the Messiah? I began to ask questions like that. And what people around me used to tell me, they used to say things like, well, when Jesus came, He said, it's really a spiritual kingdom. But I'm thinking in my teenage mind that that was really sort of unfair. I mean, I thought John the Baptist was right. when he sent those people, he said, are you the Messiah? Because I was saying the same thing. Is this the Messianic kingdom? So John didn't have faith. But I said, man, I can see why he was saying that. I can see why the Jews rejected Jesus. How would they connect what Jesus was doing with what they read in the Old Testament? Really look at that. There's a really troubling difference. And then some people say, of course, well, that's because Christianity is a new religion, and the Old Testament isn't connected with the New, and the Old Testament is all about the physical Israel and everything, and the New Testament has nothing to do with that. But that really bothered me. Is that the best that God could do to integrate two Testaments? It just seemed to me to fall woefully short. And the second sort of, so I had these questions lingering. How do I put this all together? Is Christianity really a new religion that has nothing to do with Judaism? What's the connection between the Testaments? How do you integrate all of Bible truth? And see, the problem was very acute, because in our church we'd exegete things from the Old Testament and apply them to us. But I was thinking, but the Old Testament doesn't have anything, that the Old Testament as a whole doesn't seem to have anything to do with us in the New Testament era. And so how do we put this all together? Is the Old Testament just a book of stories that we get some moral instruction from? Or just what is it, and what is the connection between all this? And then the problem got really acute when we came to Philadelphia here. And we became part of a Christian community. We were trying to do Christian community in a serious way here in Philadelphia. And Carolyn and I really thought this was great. But then the problem was, then there were some crises that we had and difficulties that we ran into. We went through a period of real doubt and real, we were doing something really radical. We were sharing things. We were reaching out into the inner city. We were working with people that nobody, not a lot of people, had thought to work with. And then we were trying to really share our life together. We never did a common purse, but we were really trying to be a community. And then that was great when things were going great. Everybody's really excited. We're sharing. We're loving. We're sharing babysitters with one another and sharing our cars when we needed them. And it had a lot of practical benefits, you know. And so we felt, wow, this is really terrific. We're leading the world. But then we had some crises, and it didn't seem to work. And then we had to really rethink, well, where did this idea come from in the first place? Are we really doing something that God's called us to do, or was this just a nice sort of yuppie idea that we twisted the Bible? And I went through a real period of crisis and evaluation and trying to figure out, how did this all fit together? And what we came up with is this, that everything I've talked about so far, the root problem was the lack of a framework. The lack of a framework within which to understand the Bible, within which to understand history, within which to understand what God is doing. What we discovered, the conclusion we came to, is that lots of Christians are out there, lots of Christian leaders out there, sort of doing their thing, and they're doing a piece of the thing. You have the social activists who, they're all beating on you to give more money to this cause or that cause, and let's go down to Washington and take it. And it's their thing. And it's part of the gospel. And then you have the sort of experientialists. They're always seeking the ultimate spiritual experience. And so they have new kind of songs that really get you into the spirit, you know, and you just feel the presence of God. And then you have the signs and wonders types, you know, who say, wow, we've got to demonstrate to the world miracles and power. And then you have the evangelists who hold crusades and stuff. I think we're saying, does anybody fit this all? Is there any fit together with all this? It's always like, you have all these Christians in different camps that hardly talk to one another. They have sort of a style, you know, you can tell, oh, this is a social activist church, or this is a missions church, or this is an evangelism type church. And so you were saying, has anybody tried to fit the whole thing together? I mean, I don't want to be an evangelism church or a deep spiritual experience church. How do you put the whole thing together? Because we were struggling here in Philadelphia to figure out, what does it mean to be a Christian community and yet evangelistic and yet have compassion for the poor and yet do all these things that the Bible says? Is there some way to fit the whole thing together? And it's out of that quest, it's out of that search that a lot of things that I'm going to share with you come. So let me dive into that by, you probably know, so I jump down to the middle of page 2. The first question that I asked a while back was, why in the world did Hebrew religion survive in the first place? See, first I thought all religions at that time were sort of unsophisticated, barbarous people doing their idolatry. That is not true. Assyrian religion, Sumerian religion was very impressive. They had a priesthood, they had monumental architectural achievements. I mean, Hebrew religion, the Hebrew culture, was really very primitive compared to what was going on in the ancient world. And the question is, why did these guys survive in the first place? Well, to understand that, you have to take a little bit of a look at what religion was like at about 2000 BC when Abraham came on the scene. There were two kinds of gods that people had. One were gods of nature. That meant the wind was a god, the sun was a god. God was either were the elements of nature or they were in the elements of nature. And the way you got ahead, of course, is you tried to, if you wanted more sun on your crops, you tried to placate the sun god with sacrifices and whatever. If you wanted more rain, then there was a god you prayed for that they would give rain. And all these gods were sort of in competition with each other and made this turbulent course of nature happen because different gods were acting capriciously to do their thing. The second kind of god that there was were gods, I call them gods of national spirit. It was like a grand manifestation of Uncle Sam. See, each little tribal group had their own national god. And your tribe either succeeded or failed militarily based on the strength, not of your army, but of your god. So if the Assyrian god was more powerful than the Egyptian god, then the Assyrian armies would win. That's the way they thought of these sorts of gods. Okay. Now, there's a problem that this created, and it's the problem of insecurity. Because the problem of this sort of a theological outlook is no one is really in control of nature. So there's no one place you can go to for any kind of sense of control. Secondly, no one was really in control of the overall social and political order. Your god just happened to be too weak and he got wiped out and enslaved by a surrounding country. It was just too bad. There's nothing you can do. There was no social order. Furthermore, there's no foundation for morality. What was right and wrong was just whoever was the strong man in your tribe decided was right and wrong. That was it. There was no rule of law. There was no sense of fairness. It's just what everybody could get away with. And that produced a very unstable social situation. Behind the impressive religious facade was a tremendous social and moral instability. And it is in the midst of this that this great revelation comes to Abraham, namely that there is one God who is sovereign over all. He made everything in nature, and he controls everything in nature. Furthermore, it is to he to whom we all give account. He defines morality. Goodness was the expression of his character. He is the Lord of history, and he calls all people to account for their actions. So Hebrew religion was not just another religion. It was fundamentally different from all the other religions of the world, and that's why it was not compatible with any of them. Some people say, oh, isn't it terrible that in Joshua's time he went in and they butchered all the nations around? Well, there's a counter question we should ask. Why did those nations, with the exception of one group, the Gibeonites, not try to make peace with Joshua? See, because these kind of tribal feuds were always happening, and one little group would make a treaty with another, and they would bargain with one another and try to have some accommodation. There was no accommodation to Joshua. I mean, it was all against him. All 31 kings in the Palestine area came against him. Now, why was there no compromise? Because the Hebrew mentality and religion represented something entirely new. It's not just having another little tribal god who was different, but more or less like all the other tribal gods. This was a group of people who believed their god was the Lord of the whole show. And you see, that's very unpopular in a pluralistic society. And this society was essentially pluralistic then. And that's the offense of Christianity nowadays, too, because we say there's one God, he's Lord over all, he's Lord over all this, but you could have your little, you could be doing your little religion, it doesn't matter, there's a God over all. That's what's offensive about Christianity. It was offensive about Hebrew religion in the second millennium BC, and it is why there was no compromise, it was why they eventually fought it out. Okay? But it was the power of Hebrew religion, and it is the foundation on which all of Western civilization, not just Christianity, but all of Western civilization was built. I went to Mongolia several years ago to give a series of lectures on Western culture, and in preparation for that, that's when I began to appreciate how much Western culture is based on the Hebrew Christian tradition. And I tried to explain that to people who really didn't understand the West. And it was a great opportunity to talk about this whole foundation and this way of looking at life, which our society is rejecting the religion, but is founded on the values of the religion. Okay. That was the strength and power of Hebrew religion. That is why you don't even know the names of the Egyptian and the Assyrian kings and stuff, but you all know the name Abraham, and Isaac and these guys, because that is why it was founded on this idea of the sovereignty of God, which is very powerful and on which all of Western civilization is built. Now, however, there's a problem with Hebrew religion, which comes up very early in the Old Testament, and that is the problem of evil. And I want to take some time to talk a little philosophically. This is very, very important for us to understand. I am frustrated when I read Christian books that talk about the problem of evil, and they say things like, well, it's a great mystery. We just don't know why this is. We don't know. I mean, if you don't understand the problem of evil, it's really impossible to witness, because what history is all about is God resolving the problem of evil. And if anything we ought to understand, we need to understand this problem of evil, because it is at the heart of what God is working on. Okay? And the three questions which I hope we can take a shot at answering this morning is: A, why is the world in the mess that it is? That is, how can a good and sovereign God permit the world's present level of evil? Okay? Second, what is God going to do about the problem of evil? And third, what does it have to do with me? Okay? These are the three big questions. Okay, now let's just talk a little philosophically. Where did evil come from? Let's jump down to that second paragraph. The problem of moral freedom. Okay. See, God cannot, goodness cannot exist without freedom. There's no such thing as patience without the possibility of impatience. There's no such thing as love without the possibility of hate. Because if you have to love, if you're programmed to love, if you were a computer programmed to love, then you're not loving, you're just responding to the program. See, the thing that makes my wife's love for me satisfying is the fact that she has a choice about it, okay? I like to think that when she was thinking about whether or not she should marry me, you know, she thought about all the thousands of men in the world, and she evaluated them all, and she said, this is the one, right? Now that's satisfying to me, okay? If she would have been a robot, if Sears would have made bridal robots, you know, and you just sent in your money and they were programmed to say, I love you, here are your pipe, and here's your pipe of slippers and all that, and I will never burn the toast and all that. I mean, I might have better toast, but it would not satisfy me, okay? Because love has to involve a choice. But if goodness involves a choice, and God wanted to create a world in which there was goodness. Now think of God's dilemma. Even God, by the way, can't do everything. Did you know that? Or at least he won't do everything. Or maybe an accurate way to say it, if you're a theologian and want to split hairs, it is inconsistent with God's character to do everything. God cannot both give you an experience and not give you that experience at the same time. That's impossible even for God, right? The way God has set things up, every step he takes limits what he can do. And so in creating a world in which there is the possibility of goodness, he also created a world, and he had to create a world in which there's a possibility of badness. The two things go together. And given a universe in which badness is possible, given the fact that some creatures have moral freedom, the outcome was that some chose evil. And that's the source of evil in the world. And we need to understand that. It's not that God did it. It's that God permitted it, and therefore some of us did it. But the good news is that God knew that was going to happen. He wasn't caught surprised. When the first sin took place, he said, ooh, whoops. He knew that was going to happen, and he had a plan to deal with that. That's what we really have to understand, okay? So God can't be directly blamed. He allowed for the possibility of evil that he created. Now what happened? Lucifer, one of his chief angels, rebelled and became Satan. A third of the angels joined that rebellion and became demons. That began a cosmic conflict which continues to this day. Okay. Satan and his four... Okay. Now the next problem. You have Satan, untempted, rebelling against God. This creates a problem. Because you can't have evil in heaven. Okay? And therefore in Revelation 12 we read there was war in heaven. When Lucifer rebelled, it precipitated a war in heaven. Well, what's God going to do about this? He has a big problem on his hand. That is why the physical universe was created. Now, let's understand some really neat things about the physical universe. It is a place that God made, and he's ultimately in control of, but he does not live in. That's the difference between Christianity and pantheism. We say God is in the sunset. We don't really mean that if we're Christians. We don't mean he's in it. He created it. He controls it. It is an expression of his beauty and majesty and all that. But he is not actually in it. And there's a genius about that. So you can imagine the angels saying, why are you making the physical universe? Our spiritual universe is so much better. You know, I mean, we can do things that those puny mortals can't imagine doing. Why in the world are you creating a place like that? And we can imagine God saying, well, wait. Because what Satan and his forces then endeavored to do, having rebelled against God and being unable to remain in the presence of God, they sought to hook themselves to the physical universe. I'll talk in a minute about what that means. Okay, so that in some sense they can escape from the presence of God and instead dominate the physical universe. That is what they sought to do. And again, God didn't say, whoops! God created this place deliberately for that. In fact, his intention was for the physical universe to be a kind of stage on which the problem of evil was to be resolved. The universe is very, very important. And therefore, when people say, oh, it's eventually going to blow up and we're going to eventually be disembodied spirits, that's wrong. God has created the physical universe, and in the life to come, incidentally, the Bible teaches we will have bodies. Think about that a little bit. I'll come to it toward the end. We'll have bodies. We'll not just be spirits floating around strumming harps. Will be an organized society. What God starts to do, he finishes. Although his route to it is not always direct. And it was a little indirect now. Okay? So Satan has temporarily gained control of this world through the fall by attaching himself to humanity through our sinfulness. And that was all part of God's intention. Now, you say, how do spirits get hooked to the physical universe? That's really a mystery. Why would spirits want to get hooked to something physical? Well, to help understand that, every one of you carries that mystery around. Every one of us carries that mystery around. We are spirits hooked to bodies, at least for the time being. And when you read in Jesus, what the demons did not want is for Jesus just to cast them out. They were even willing to go into a group of pigs. Somehow they really, really wanted to be hooked down here. They feared being completely disembodied because somehow that put them in the presence of God, which apparently was very disagreeable or painful or something to them. And so they wanted somehow to be hooked here. But from God's point of view, they are trapped here. He's got them here so that he can deal with all that stuff. Okay, now then the question arises. We have this mess, and that's where the mess comes from in the physical world. And I think it's good for us to be able to explain to people, this is the drama, this is where all this mess comes from. So then the next question is, what is God going to do about evil? Now let's look at his options. Why doesn't God destroy evil? Well, because he can't destroy evil. He can't destroy evil without destroying creatures whom it's infected. See, he has a real problem here. You know, you don't want to cure the problem by killing the patient. Okay, and it would be a real disappointment to think, well, God says, okay, I destroyed evil. And the angels say, well, what's left in your universe? Well, there are no people left, of course. We have some angels left, but this whole... And that was kind of a disappointing solution, but God can't do it that way. See, the spiritual is permanent. And so you can't destroy what's permanent. By the way, evil is not going to be ultimately destroyed. It is going to be confined, and there's a difference. In hell, people are still going to be free to sin, because that's what they want to do. And God eventually lets us do what we want to do. But they're not going to have the chance to mess it up for all the rest of us. See, that's what God is working for. He's eventually giving people their true choice. But he can't destroy it because he has made us free, and he has made us spirits, and spirits are permanent. And so he has to work in a little more ingenious way. Okay, now what does he do? He does not eliminate pain and suffering, but he limits it so that, first of all, it doesn't overwhelm us, and second, so that his purposes are not thwarted. In other words, he hasn't just given over this physical universe to Satan to do anything he wants. He limits what Satan does. He is still going to accomplish his purposes here, but there's a certain amount of freedom that Satan and his forces have, and that's the source of all the mess in this world. We've got to understand that and look at it. Second, he has to allow the consequences of our choices to play out, because evil by its very nature produces pain and suffering. They're necessary consequences of evil. So he can't stop the pain and suffering if he doesn't stop evil, and he can't stop evil without reducing us to puppets. So you see, God has a problem here, and he's got to work a solution out in such a way that he does not violate what he has already done. Okay, evil has real power, and the power has yet to be defeated. And finally, God's intention is to work redemptively through evil. Okay, so then what is God's plan? Okay, here's God's plan. He has a different goal than we think. His plan is to reduce the power of evil to zero, to reduce its power, which is different from eliminating it. See, the problem with evil for us is that it has a power over us. If I said, how many of you plan to go out and sin today? Whenever you say, no, I don't plan to sin. Well, then why do you sin? Because evil is seductive. It has a power. It catches us at our weak moments. Okay? That's the problem with it. And what God is in the process of doing in history is reducing the power of evil to zero so that we will not be seduced by it anymore, and in the age to come, we will voluntarily and willfully choose what's right. We've had talks about,
No, I use the following illustration. When we lived here in Philadelphia, I drove across the Ben Franklin Bridge to New Jersey many times. I could have driven my car off the side of the bridge any time I wanted. Was I about to do that? No, because that would have seemed like a ridiculous choice. I never was tempted. I didn't hold the steering wheel and say, I wonder if I should turn and go off the side of the bridge. I mean, you all smile at that, and that would have seemed a ridiculous thing for me to do, and yet it was possible. Now, if you understand that, that's what sin is going to look like to us in heaven. It will look like something that's just completely ridiculous to do. It will still be theoretically possible, because remember, you can't love without the possibility of hating it. And so when we're patient toward one another in heaven, we will value it because we know we could have been impatient. We will love one another, and that you can't have love without the possibility of hate, but we will no longer be deceived by it. We will no longer be deceived by evil. That's what's different. In other words, its power will have been reduced to evil and confined in hell. The reason people are going to wind up in hell is because that's where they want to be. And the rest of us are not going to want to be there. So God's going to say, okay, you guys want to do this and be there. Well, that's fine. And you guys don't. And that's fine with me too. You're going to get your choice. So people say, God sends people to heaven. In one sense, that's true. But in another sense, it's the choice that people make. When people want to be without God, God says, okay, that's what you're going to be. Now, I've gone through all this to get us to the point where we really understand now the significance of history. What is happening in history from the time of the fall all the way down until Jesus comes? This is what is happening in its essence. God is working to reduce the power of evil to zero. And that's the big picture. And that's not just a little piece. That's the big picture of what's going on. Now I want to talk a little bit about how he's doing that. Okay?
Okay. Oh, but let me, this is really important enough, so let me, on page 4 if you're following, 8 areas of impact of the kingdom paradigm. When you see this, and you see what the kingdom of God is all about, and what's happening, it has major impact in all of these areas. So let me just take a minute to go through. It has impact in the area of evangelism, because the question is evangelism offering people fire, taking people through a short prayer which offers them fire insurance in the age to come? Or is it a call to participate in what God is doing in the here and now? And how you evangelize and what message and what you say to people is an enormous consequence of what you think about this in terms of evangelism. Is the inner life, our walk with the Lord, is its purpose to make us feel good, give us ecstatic experiences, and bring us a kind of spiritual pleasure? Or is its purpose to equip us to be adequate servants and participants in what God is doing in the world? And that's a very, that would, depending on how you answer that question, you will either veer off into an introspective pietism, or your inner life will be shaped and molded so that you can become an effective person and participate in what God is doing. Is the church a voluntary and optional part of God's plan in which you go for fellowship and just meeting people and having a good time? Or is it intended by God to be a community that infiltrates the world and demonstrates by its life and action and the relationships between people what life in the age to come will be like? And depending on how you answer that question, or how you do church, depends a lot on what you really believe is the answer to that question. So if we are the city set on a hill to demonstrate to people, is the gospel tell or is it show and tell? Do we tell people, or do we tell them and show them, this is what happens, this is what it's going to be like, if you want to know what it's going to be like when Jesus comes back, come to our Christian community and you will see it in action. Are we infiltrating this present evil culture under the domination of Satan with its materialism and its hedonism and its superficiality? Are we infiltrating it and creating an alternate society that prophetically says, you are wrong, the values of this society are corrupt and degraded, and here is the alternative? Are we showing as well as telling? And I want to submit to you that what you think about that will have an enormous impact on how you do church. Is mission an optional call for a few, or is it part of God's eternal plan to have people from every tribe and tongue and nation incorporated into this glorious church that's coming forth on earth? Were signs and wonders just something to validate Jesus' ministry? Or were they something that was connected with the coming of the kingdom to this world and therefore an integral part of our apologetic? Are they part of the show as well, showing the world that the kingdom of God has come in a convincing, supernatural way? Is social transformation just an add-on that a few compassionate people do? Or does the church create just social structures and reach out in compassion to needy people, because that is what Jesus is doing, and because in the age to come there will be no poverty, there will be no tears, there will be no pain, and therefore when we do social transformation, we do it out of a sense of doing what the world is becoming? And I suggest that whether you do it or get excited about it has a lot to do with how you answer that question. Is discipleship an optional thing for the spiritual few who want to be spiritual leaders? Or is it integral to God's plan to make us effective in what He is doing in the world? Is the life in the Spirit some sort of ecstatic experience just for our enjoyment? Or is the conscious experience of the power of the Holy Spirit a necessary part of our equipment so that we can engage the hostile spiritual forces that are coming against what God is doing in the world? And again, I talk to a lot of people who think that life in the Spirit is some sort of optional or advanced sort of thing. They say, well, you know, I don't know if that's for me. And I'm always thinking, are you engaging the enemy and saying that the power of the Spirit might not be for you? I don't understand that. I certainly do not want to go up against demonic. If we really believe we're going up against demonic forces, I do not want to do it with just what I bring to the table, right? And so to be empowered by the Spirit becomes a vital issue if we really see ourselves as engaging dark, hostile forces and being part of what God is doing to bring them down in anticipation of Jesus' coming. See, what you think has a lot to do, or how you act, or how you work it all out, has a lot to do with what you really think, okay? Okay. Now, I have to go real quick through some milestones in the Old Testament. I'm just, in a sense, really going to name them. I want to, in a few minutes, just finish up here and give us a little bit of a break. But let's get into it. Just to make it simple for people, I've tried to identify 8 major milestones in the Old Testament to help understand how the Old Testament fits together with the New. The first is the idea of the sovereignty of God, which we've already talked about. It's the It was a revolutionary Hebrew idea. There was one God, sovereign over all, and the implication for us is that God is king. And the implication is that what he is doing in the world is becoming king. He's not retired. He's not just sitting in heaven passively. He is becoming, he is working to become the king that he rightfully is. Okay, secondly, the idea of peoplehood. In about 2000 BC, Abraham was called, and he was told, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go into the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the peoples of the earth will be blessed by you. This is an incredibly important verse. What he said, says to Abraham, you've got to get out of your environment, get into another country, I'm going to make you a nation. And through this nation, I'm going to bless everybody, God's plan. And how is God going to regain control of the world? Answer, by producing a people. And in their corporate life together, do something so wonderful that the rest of the world will be drawn to God through that. That comes through in another passage from Deuteronomy. Skip down on page 5 if you want to read with me. Again, I consider these some of the most unknown and yet important verses in the Bible. This is Moses saying to the nation of Israel what their destiny is. Okay, he said this, see, I have taught you decrees and laws that the Lord my God commanded you so that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of it. Okay, now look at this really carefully. Observe them carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nation, who will hear about all these decrees and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. What other nation is so great as to have their gods near them the way the Lord our God is near us whenever we pray to him? And what other nation is so great as to have such righteous decrees and laws as this body of laws I'm setting before you today? Let me just sort of expand that a little bit so that the impact doesn't miss. God's intention for Israel was not simply to bless Israel for Israel's sake, but to bless Israel so that they could be an example to the nations. And this is how it was going to work. He was going to institute a just legal system, a just social system, a joyful religious system, an enlightened way of families relating to one another. Okay? He was going to arrange their social system that there would be no poverty, that there would be no oppression. He gave a detailed description of how this should be. And the idea was, this was going to be so terrific that the other nations were going to come around and say, what are you doing? How come your people prosper when we're suffering? How come there's no injustice? How come there's no oppression? And that was intended to be their introduction, the nation's introduction to Yahweh of the Hebrew people. Do you understand that? Now here's the radical thing. God has never given up on that plan, even though Israel failed, because Jesus says, you are the light of the world, a city on a hill. He is still working to bring forth that city on a hill, which is a light to the nations. Now do you see what the problem is when we look at the church the way it is now? The church has no idea by and large that this is what we're supposed to be. See, I almost always find myself apologizing for the church, because we haven't got this. And so we look the same self. We say, well, you know, you can't go by the Christians in our church. I think an unbeliever says, well, then what can I go by? If this stuff really works, will you please show me where it's working? We have all our problems. Well, you know, people are sinful, and people are too busy, and people are, you know, there are some people who are, well, they say, well, will you show me somewhere where this stuff that you say is the power of God for salvation is really working? Do you see why the building of Christian community the way it is intended to be is such a high priority issue? Because our words are undermined by the fact that we can't show it. Okay? And I think the world has a right to say, show us. And in fact, Jesus said this. He said, by this will all men know that you're my disciples, that you love one another. What was he talking about? People seeing love in action. Love is not sitting, not having a group of unrelated people in a meeting, somebody says, okay, let's stand up and everybody greet one another and hug one another, and we all love one another. Baloney! You don't even know one another. I mean, frankly, I get offended when they do that in church. I was in a church that says, everybody get up and love on one another. And it's people who never even looked me in the eye, who never knew my name, hugging and slobbering over me, and say, you don't love me, you don't know anything about me. You know, and after this meeting is over, you will forget that you ever... This is not loving one another. This is a cheap... And I think the world has a right to come in and say, this is cheap garbage. It is not love. But if there's a Christian community created where people of different racial backgrounds, cultural situations, people who are very different come together and really love one another, Jesus says, that's how the world is going to know your disciples. See, we're out there. We wonder, why is evangelism so hard? You know, we're telling people, you know, invite Jesus into your life, you know, the power of God. I think these people are saying, well, like, where can I go see this? And he said, no, you can't see it. You just got to believe it. And I think people have a right to say, this lacks credibility, okay? So the coming forth of the people of God was central to God's purpose for Abraham on down, and it's central to his purpose now. Okay, then the next thing was covenant. I'm really sorry, because of the time I can't go into it. This is so important. Covenant was a way of God relating to people in which God became our sovereign and gives us protection and gives us blessing, and we owe him our love and our allegiance and our loyalty. It's a love based not out of feeling, which is where we are in the 20th century. It is a love that comes out of a kind of relationship that we have. And we come to the altar and somebody says to us, this is the blood of the new covenant. We participate in communion. I was always weak because I have a feeling that most people have no idea what they were saying when they say that, because we don't adequately understand the idea of covenant in the Old Testament. So I don't have time to go into that. There's a tremendous amount to that. Okay, the next is the idea of deliverance, that God delivered his people out of their bondage in Egypt, and conversion is a deliverance. It is a deliverance from the power of Satan to blind our eyes and to bring us into the kingdom. Okay, the fifth is the idea of the law. And again, in this brief survey, I want to just say the law really has a bad rap in the 20th century. People are always worried about legalism, that just being legalistic. At the end of the 20th century, there's almost no churches that have problems with legalism. We have problems with hedonism, not legalism. We accept almost anything, and our mentality is never to examine anything, and you can live, you know, you live the way you please, you find it in the Bible, and whatever God speaks to you is okay. Just to get some perspective on it, David said, the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. I just want to ask you, is that the way the law is portrayed in our theology? Now, I want to be clear. We cannot come to God through acts of the law. That's what Romans is all about. I'm really Orthodox. But we've got to be careful that we don't throw out something that the inspired scripture says was perfect and wonderful. The law gives us a method of relating to one another without transgressing each other's rights, and it's very important. Six. On the next page was wisdom. We're not only given the law, which gives us boundaries, we're given principles for success and prosperity. So God tells us not only how we need to live in order not to transgress someone else's boundaries, but also principles for success. It's God's desire for us to be successful and blessed. And so he gives us methods of doing it. Okay, now we come to the prophets. I will take a couple minutes on this. Then the question is, this is a wonderful, you see the destiny. Okay, Israel, you're supposed to be the example people. A, you're going to be incredibly blessed. Secondly, if you implement this, people around you are going to be tremendously blessed. You are the focal point of my purposes. Question, did Israel ever do this? Answer, mostly no. It is true that the Queen of Sheba came, and there's this, she said to Solomon, wow, the half hasn't been told me about how wonderful your whole system is. But by and large, the Hebrews never did this. And so along come the prophets. They reached their peak in about the 8th century B.C., or their prophets before that. And what do the prophets do and say? Okay, they were sent to call the nation back to its original destiny. They were men on whom the Spirit of God came. They were moral and social reformers. They denounced empty external religion and called for moral cleansing and reformation of the social order. You can't neglect that, on the prophets, okay? They were analysts. They were international observers and critics. And they came up with a grand solution to what was happening. See, what they saw, and what any astute person would have seen, is society gradually sliding down into decline. And yes, there were momentary revivals, but the general trend was downward. And then the question everybody has is, well, where is this going to end? And the solution they came up with was what they called the Day of the Lord. Okay? What they said is this, this was the beginning of eschatology, this is the beginning of eschatology in the Hebrew mind. History, they said, was divided into two portions. There's the present age, in which there would be decline, defeat, and ultimately captivity. But then there were going to be what they called the end time, or the age to come, in which there was purification, restoration, and a golden era was to be ushered in. And they saw a division point in history that they called the Day of the Lord. So the prophets were pessimistic. If you ask them what's going to happen in the short run, they said it's going downhill. That's going to end in captivity and defeat and disintegration. But the prophets are amazingly optimistic about the long run. You don't find any prophet that's really ultimately pessimistic. They all say, but God is going to intervene in history. What they call the Day of the Lord. A messianic figure is going to arise and appear, and he is going to restore the fortunes of Israel. He's going to eliminate their political, he's going to take them out from under their political oppression. He is going to change people's hearts and restore them to what God intended them to be. He's going to pour out his spirit. There's a couple things that the prophet said, let me just hit on them. The change is going to take place because he's going to pour out the Holy Spirit to empower them. And he's going to make a new covenant with people. He's going to write the laws of God on their hearts and minds, not just on tables of stone. How is this going to, transformation is going to happen? Through a remnant. In the prophets, we have the idea of a minority of redeemed people who experience a profound cleansing and transformation, and they bring the rest of the nation back to God. And they do so in part through suffering. Okay. The Messiah suffers, and the prophetic remnant also suffers. This is the prophet's solution to what's going on. Now there's one last group of people, the apocalyptists, but I think I want to do that, I want to talk about that in the next hour. What I'd like to do is have us first, if you have any questions so far, I'll talk about that. I hope to leave some, maybe 15 minutes at the end to let you ask some questions and begin some discussion about this, because I realize it's a little hard to absorb. But if anybody has a question now, I'll take that, and then I'm going to let you get up and stretch and scratch and stuff with you. Yes, Scott.
Just, you can maybe say this to the end if you think it's better, but when you talk about reducing the power of evil to zero, does that mean we should be seeing evil decreasing in this life?
Okay, yeah. Let me leave that to the end. That's a very important question. Let me just say this, just so you get the idea in anticipation. The kingdom of God is neither triumphalistic, it does not predict, as you will see, that when Jesus comes, evil will have been eliminated. In fact, evil will have been polarized. The church will have come forth in wonderful glory when Jesus comes. And society, apart from the church, will be in total chaos. So we will not transform society, but we will be a prophetic witness within society. We'll see that as we come to the end. That's the way Revelation. So it's not triumphalistic, okay? But neither is it pessimistic. Most Christian theology is either too triumphalistic or too pessimistic. You have, I don't want to offend people who have been part of the religious right, but the place that I think the religious right is really wrong is their idea that we can sort of Christianize society by putting, not everybody in the religious right believes that, but we're not going to get politicians who are gradually going to make society more and more Christian. It's not going to happen. It's going to be a polarization. The church is going to come forth in glory. Evil is going to become worse. Okay? But we're not pessimistic either. See, a lot of us have very pessimistic theology, just waiting to be raptured out of here for God to blow the place up. That's not right either. What God's going to do is do something tremendous on earth, which will astonish the whole earth and make it impossible for any person on earth not to understand what God is doing. That's what we're headed for. The church will be so wonderful and glorious and such a wonderful example of what the life of the end time people will be, that there will be no excuse for anyone to reject it, okay? But many will. And that will precipitate God's righteous judgment. See, do you understand? I can understand why people nowadays might say, I don't know, I want to become part of this people of God. I mean, churches are a wreck, they've divided there. I can, in a way, understand it. But at the end, there'll be no excuse, because there'll be something so wonderful which shall have place on the earth through the likes of us, okay? So there'll be no excuse. And then because people still reject that, then Jesus comes and is the final judgment and the whole thing ends. And everybody will say that is richly deserved. When you reject something this terrific, there's no more hope and no more excuse. That's where history seems to be moving, okay? But you can see that means we are neither pessimistic and give up on life and society, nor are we naive, okay? And the practical implication is, there are people ask us, do you guys think you're going to change North Philadelphia healthcare? No. But we believe we're going to, the goal was to be a prophetic witness in the middle of that, to say to all of North Philadelphia, the corrupt healthcare systems that are denying healthcare to the poor, what we're there to do is say, this is the way Jesus does it. Whether or not you all get on the bandwagon, that's between you and God. Our job is to say, this is the way that Jesus wants it done, so there's no excuse for you to do it any other way. You see, that's being a prophetic people without being naive about the fact that that'll be rejected. That model of healthcare is mostly rejected by society. But we want them to know that this is the way Jesus does it. And so that's the way we're doing it. You see that mentality? That's very important. Yeah.
Yeah. This idea that the world is created to resolve the problem of evil. The big question is, well, where is it? Where is it found?
There's no one verse that says exactly that. But when you look at Jesus' ministry, and when he talks about the purpose that he came into the world and how he commissions us to be, it comes down to that is his thrust was God is working. Well, you see that a little more. Maybe I should hold that a little bit until we come to the New Testament. The way Jesus engaged the world, that was the whole thrust of it. The kingdom of God has come. God has invaded, and now God is transforming history without yet ending it. Okay. I think I've answered that very well. Maybe I should, why don't you, if you're still bothered by that, maybe you should talk after you hear the rest, okay? Because you'll see it a little quicker. Yeah?
A similar question that I think that was there some overarching purpose or motivation in the creating the angel and maybe the same one?
In creating the angels, and I don't know if there was a specific motivation. I mean, God is a very creative God, and he just loved to create things. He loved to create creatures, and it seems like he created angels to populate the spiritual world where he lived. Okay? And with some of the same motivation that he has in creating us, for fellowship among themselves and with him, God desired to experience fellowship with his created beings, and so he created spiritual beings. And then he created us in this world for the same reason, and endowed us with these limited powers that we have for deliberate reasons, so that we both be vulnerable, but in trusting him, he could use vulnerable creatures to finally defeat all evil, so that he gets the glory by doing it. Not really. I mean, the genius of this is, God does this not by overpowering Satan directly, but empowering vulnerable creatures who by their collective activity defeat a more powerful foe. I mean, it's a great story, and this is how God gets glory. In a sense, it's like in Job, he doesn't just protect Job completely. He lets Job go through the trial, and the defeat of Satan and the defeat of evil has something to do with the fact that this vulnerable guy who didn't know what was going on still in some sense stayed true. And God's doing the same thing with all of us. Us vulnerable people buffeted. The angels are not impressed with us. They think, man, these people, they can't even jump 6 feet off the ground. And this is the group of people that's going to defeat Satan and his minions. And God says, yes, this is the group that's going to do it. And I think that gives us an incredible destiny and yet a kind of humility. Because we are vulnerable and yet we have an incredible destiny. And it seems to me that when we get that tension right in our hearts, we're really equipped to do something. We don't overestimate ourselves. We see our sinfulness. We don't underestimate ourselves either. We realize we are the people who are going to do it. And if we don't do it, then it's just going to be a next generation. Some group of people is really going to do this. So it's a very exciting kind of thing. And I hope you start to see how all these tensions help us get it right so that we don't go off in one. We're neither too optimistic or not too pessimistic. We have the right balance, the right tension. let's take 5 minutes and just stretch, and then we'll go on a little more.